Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, a place where you'll receive a boost of inspiration, practical advice, and tools to maximize your success and personal happiness. And that's not all. You'll also get plenty of guidance on how you can use your gifts, talents, and compassion to contribute towards making the world a better place. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter for a preview of what's in store and to also receive a free ebook. To sign up, simply visit www.thedreamcatch.com. Now it's my pleasure to introduce you to the host of the Dreamcatcher Podcast, Celine Chinoy.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, a place where your dreams can find a voice. One of the most important qualities that we can develop as human beings is empathy. And this has become increasingly important as we try to build a bridge across races, cultures, and classes and create a more connected and peaceful society. My guest today, Wendy Sanford, had to reckon with her identity and her privilege to get to this level of understanding and to teach it to others. In her new memoir, Wendy tells a story of her 60-year-old friendship with Mary Norman, a Black woman who she met when they were both teenagers. The daughter of an upper-middle-class suburban family in Princeton, New Jersey, she comes of age within the cultural revolutions of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Informed and fueled by the writings of women of color, she begins to deal with the impact of her training in the habits of dominance and her privilege as she and Miss Norman seek to become friends. In our conversation, we discuss themes that Wendy's book centers on and how it can help us become more aware of our biases. Wendy also shares her thoughts on how we can develop genuine friendships with people of all types and do our part to combat racism. And if you like what you heard, please don't forget to like, rate, share, and subscribe to this podcast. Thank you. Hello, Wendy. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here. I'm doing well. Thank you. How about you?
I'm doing great. I am so glad that you're here with us. And I am looking forward to learning more about your story that you've penned so beautifully in your new book, These Walls Between Us, a memoir of friendship across race and class. It is a wonderful story. And I think you touch upon some very important and timely issues around race and privilege. So we're definitely going to have a lot to talk about.
We are. And I'll be so interested to hear the parts that particularly were interesting to you too, because there's a lot in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's start out by talking about your friendship with Mary Norman. What caused you to befriend her and see her differently?
You know, I would say the whole book is kind of the answer to that question.
Okay.
So I'll be much briefer.
Okay.
So I come from an upper middle class white suburban family in New Jersey. And when I was 12 years old, my parents decided we had, you know, enough money. We could have our first summer vacation in a rental cottage by the sea in New England for a whole month. And that my mother would have help. So she asked around among her friends and she found a young woman from rural Western Virginia, a young Black woman to come all the way up to Massachusetts to help to be what was called a summer helper. But as I look at it now, it was plain domestic worker with all, even though she was only 15 years old, she did all the heavy work in the house for that, you know, that summer. And So when I met her, she was 15. She had just traveled hundreds and hundreds of miles through the Jim Crow South, through the Jim Crow Middle Atlantic states, all the way up to all on her own, all the way up to this remote beach enclave where she didn't see another Black person the whole summer, really. It was a very lonely place for her, but it was a very important job for her. It was her first live-away job, and her parents depended on her, and she was determined to do a good job. Her family's just close to the line poverty, needing her to do this work. And I was 12. I was, you know, the daughter of a prosperous young white couple. I was the privileged daughter. And the fascinating thing to me now, looking back on it, was now that I've read a lot more and understood a lot more about domestic service and white employers and Black employees, that Mary was supposed to learn everything she could about me so that she could cater to my needs. And I was not supposed to learn anything about her. It just, I grew up within a white mindset that just thought we were superior.
Had you seen any Black person before meeting Mary?
I had, you know, in my town, my mother always took a shortcut through the a section of town where more Black people lived and immigrants. And okay. she took me through there, and she used that street as an example. When there was a dress that I liked that I wanted to get, if the colors were too garish, she'd say, "Oh, mm-hmm. That dress is too Witherspoon Street." Meaning it was in bad taste, meaning it was like, so you see how I grew up, that those
that you were indoctrinated, you were indoctrinated into that belief that
I was.
Yeah.
So I felt friendly and we, towards Mary, and she was at work, but she was terribly lonely. So she came back just about every summer for the next 3 or 4 decades, even as she got into full-time work, a full-time career in corrections, my mother would beg her to take her vacation time, leave her children, and come work for my mother, because my mother thought she just couldn't have a good vacation without Mary's presence, because Mary was so good at that, that job as well as others. And we kind of went on that way, except that it was so lonely for her in this just totally white area. And I was kind of a friendly person. So we kind of got friendly, and then took a big turn in our 40s, early 40s, when late 30s, really, when all of a sudden we were both divorced. We were both single parents. She was leading the way for women in corrections in New Jersey, although she wasn't. She was the first officer female officer in corrections in New Jersey in that time. And I was very active then as a feminist health writer. And I was also less and less attracted to the way my parents were living and seeing the world. So she
and what
and I
caused
started
that?
Walking on.
What caused that shift in you?
You know, so many people grow up and say, I don't want to be like my parents in this way or that way. I mean, we all do that. And for me, it started pretty young, and particularly in my late 20s when I became a feminist. And just started wanting, I wanted a different kind of relationship than they had. I didn't want to assume that white people were better. I became a Democrat.
And this was in the 60s or the 70s, so that people can get a sense of what the social climate
70s.
Was?
This was in the 70s. My shift started coming in the 70s with the women's health movement, and I was active in the anti-war movement. I mean, it was a very turbulent decade.
Even the 60s, for that matter. Yes.
So a lot of civil rights activism. So I was starting to become aware that I'd grown up in a very narrow bubble.
It takes a special kind of person to get that, because, you know, it's how do you get that consciousness to step out of the bubble that you grew up in? So that's great.
Yes. I was talking with someone yesterday, a white podcaster, and I said that when I remember back to when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, I'd sit in the living room with my parents, and they'd be drinking, because that was a thing they did, and actually ended up taking my mother's life. They'd tell jokes about, you know, that they thought were so funny about Black people, about Jewish people, about Catholics even. I mean, they were like white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and they felt superior.
Gosh.
Everyone else was kind of ridiculous in some way, or there was some funny thing to tell about them. And I would just sit in my chair cringing, feeling so uncomfortable with those jokes, although I just knew they made me uncomfortable. So I got known in the family as the person without a sense of humor, because I wouldn't laugh at those jokes. So I know it went way back, whatever in me made those shifts away from that very narrow white bubble that I grew up in.
Did Mary have an impact on your opinion? Was that what kind of created that crack for you to open up?
The crack was there before she came into my life, before I was 12. But it's absolutely part of the story, because I think as she and I started to walk, I mean, this was in our early 40s, as we started to walk and talk and share more of our lives, we came to love each other. And that caring for her was part of what moved me to learn more and more, as much as I possibly could, about African American history and life in this country. So I started reading everything I could get my hands on. And I'm sure some of the motivation was caring for Mary. Other motivation was, as a feminist, you probably know that early second wave feminism, the white women kind of took it over. And as a white, I was part of a white women's health group, and we got messages very early on from particularly African American women's health activists. Listen, you're just focusing on white issues. You are just not, you think you can talk for all women, but you can't. So I was getting that message both intellectually and in my heart. And so that's why I really started on a big campaign to learn a great deal. I just read and read and read. And then Mary and I would meet each summer and talk more. And I'll say one more thing. I think what generated the book, two things. One is, she said one day, we've got to write a book about our friendship. It's no one would believe us. And so that's what got us started. I can't remember the other thing I was going to say. But.
You know, and I think you did the right thing, because it's so pertinent. It's on everyone's mind, but the whole new wave of social justice and activism that was started up by George Floyd's death in 2020. And what do you think about all of that? Do you think it's improved? Do you think it's reduced the racial disparities in our society?
Well, that's a huge and really important question, isn't it?
I mean, I'm seeing more representation in the media and things like that. I'm seeing more sensitivity in language and in representation.
Yes, and you hope deeply. I hope deeply that leads to or is part of systemic change, you know, so that, because look at all the pushback right now around voting rights. where many states, particularly under Republican leadership, are seeking to reduce access to the vote rather than increase access to the vote. Like my state, Massachusetts, is just considering new laws that would make voting by mail more possible, early voting possible, all the things that give access to the vote to people who may work full time at jobs they really can't afford to take time off on, for instance, to vote. So my state's doing that. And there's some other states who are totally, who have passed laws to really reduce access to the vote. So that's, so yes, I agree with you that there's more representation sometimes, even in the Oscars, and in Congress, but, the deeper changes, the systemic changes, have to come too. And we just all have to work for that.
Yeah, I think it'll take a few decades for that to happen, right, Wendy? Because it's so deeply entrenched that it's going to take a while to undo all of that.
Yes, and it's interesting. I think white people would say, well, it's moving along. And I think that particularly for African-American people in this country who were stolen from their own land and brought here to build the country and then receiving really none of the rewards, I think for them, it's like, it's so overdue. It is so overdue.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and there are other minorities like the Latino community and the Native Americans.
Yes, yes.
Asians, yeah.
This country now has the first indigenous person in a major cabinet role that I know of, Deborah Haaland. And that's the kind of change that you're naming that's exciting to see. And let's see if we can keep it going and keep opening up and keep having more representation at every level.
Yeah, let's hope so.
I finally remembered the second thing I was going to say about how the book came about. So Mary and I started to become better and better friends and to tell each other more of the truth. But a big part of the story for me was how many mistakes I made. Because I came to this friendship with all just steeped in the attitudes of white superiority and all of that. And there's some very poignant moments that I write about in the book where I would say or do something that showed great ignorance of Mary's life, even though we'd been friends for all those years, or that it's hurt her in a way that I didn't intend to, but I was just, I was committing microaggressions, which are things that often a white person doesn't know, doesn't understand that they're saying something that's hurtful because it piles up on a whole history of insult or of a sense of being less than.
Do you mind giving an example, please?
I'd love to. So, one summer when Mary and I, my parents weren't so comfortable with our becoming closer friends.
I wouldn't
mind. Yeah, yeah. And as Mary remembers, you know, we used to have to whisper a lot.
Really?
Because it was a small vacation house. And, you know, we'd be talking. And anyway, so one summer when I came up after I was divorced, and I really looked forward to chatting with Mary, and seeing Mary was my main thing I loved doing.
Confidence.
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, and just we were just exploring new territory. We did, you know. My mother said, I hope this summer vacation that you're on now, you will see some of your friends. Meaning my white friends. And it shows you what it was like in the 70s and 80s, and maybe in a lot of white families that she didn't see my friendship with Mary on the same it didn't fall in the same category as my friendships with the white friends I had. So when Mary and I were walking that week, at one point I said, you know, we started talking about my mother because, we worried about her drinking and stuff like that. And I said to Mary, you know, Mom wants me to see my friends more. And then I heard myself and I thought, oh, aww, my heavens, that implies that. Yeah, exactly. I just said, oh, I didn't mean that. But the word, it was already out. And the reason to me that's a good example of a microaggression is I didn't intend it to be hurtful, yeah, but I didn't think. And in fact, everything Mary saw in the news, in magazines, in movies, in how people treated her, gave her the message that she was inferior and less of value than white people. And so my saying this and implying somehow that she wasn't the same kind of friend was a small thing, but with a microaggression, it's not small because it builds up, it piles up.
It's like adding salt to her wound.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And just implying that somehow she was less of a friend to me when that was the whole point. We were just really excited about becoming friends. So that's my example. It's the best example I can think of. So in moments like that, particularly as it comes to care about someone more and more, you don't want to do that. But how do you not do that with the level of ignorance that white people are trained into about the lives of people of color? So that's why I started educating myself even more.
Right, right. And do you think that's the solution to racism? First of all, I want to ask you, Wendy, like you witnessed this firsthand your whole life, and even your parents, you know, they had their prejudices. What do you think could be the root cause of racism?
Oh, my heavens. What a big, significant question.
Let's hear it. Let's hear your answer.
I know you're going to hear my deep, thoughtful silence here.
Would love to hear it.
So I haven't thought to try to answer that question before. Let me just give it a try. When presented with that deep a question, I would often go to my black teachers in print, I call them. I'd go to James Baldwin. I'd go to Toni Morrison. I'd go to Ta-Nehisi Coates in the more current time to try to understand, because they have a much better idea than I would about the origins of racism. To me, I think greed has a lot to do with it. I think that the dominant group, which, you know, in this country is, and in the so-called Western world is white people, affluent white people. You set up a system that's going to work best for you. And so for a long time for many centuries, race wasn't even thought of, and limiting people's access to possibility and success and health because of their race didn't happen. But then as the dominant white culture started to try to set up a system that would benefit us, it was really convenient to have a whole group, a whole class, a whole body of people who were given much less access, who had to work to do the work to build our country for our wealth. So I think that race became a convenient tool. Racism became a convenient tool in service of greed. That's what I would say. How about you?
That's a great answer. I think it's pretty much I agree with you. I think there's also an element of fear, because I know it sounds paradoxical, but I think it takes this, you know, person who doesn't feel confident in themselves, they feel inferior for them to put others down. Because if they really believed in themselves, mm-hmm. if they felt strong in their self-worth, if they believed in themselves, they would not have the need to put others down.
Yes.
And I think it's also the lack of compassion and empathy. I think that's also really huge. Just not being able to see the world through another person's eyes. And this is not just racism, and this could apply to anything.
Yes.
Just not having that sensitivity that.
And how do we nurture that in our children and our, you know, and in
Correct.
Ourselves? There's also what aggravates it is when these systems get set up, like in this country, you can be a white person, particularly a white person with some, you know, middle-class white person, and barely see a person of color in your whole day. You send your children, you try to send your white children to schools where they're mostly white children and white teachers. You have your friendship circle is all white. I mean, that's fortunately there's a lot of people who move beyond that, but it's a very segregated country. In many parts of the country, so you live a very segregated life, and that gets back to the fear that you mentioned.
Exactly.
If you don't know people, the fear can be aggravated and built up.
Yeah, and I think as humans, instinctually, we are always on guard when we are dealing with someone who's different from us, you know?
And right. So some of that is human. Yeah, some of that is human. And then there's so many myths out there. Like, how about the myth that that Black men are dangerous sexually to white women, you know? When in fact, in our history, it was the white owners, the white enslavers who were dangerous to Black women. But that gets all twisted around and a whole myth came up. And so when you have those myths that aren't challenged, it adds to the fear that you were talking
about. Yeah. But who changed the narrative? Is it just the people in power?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, because the sexual violence of the white slave owner and overseers was also in service of greed, because under enslavement, if a Black woman had a child, an enslaved woman had a child, that became the property of the white owner. So it was both lust and greed at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that was, these were people who called themselves Christians. So you couldn't really admit to that, the sexual abuse and the rape. You couldn't admit to that even in yourself. You had to have some justification for it, something that made sense. Mm-hmm. And I do think those myths, it's a whole study about how the opposite gets lifted up as a myth. Gets generated as a myth, like watch out for Black men, they're so dangerous, or they're so
that stereotype.
Yes, the stereotypes are, you know, every stereotype is in service of the dominant group, really.
Right. I mean,
so that the whole myth of that the Black people are lazy. I can't even put those words together without just cringing, because who built this country? It was the labor of the enslaved Black people. And as you say, more recently of migrants from Latin America, the farm workers, I mean, totally underpaid, undervalued people who actually built the wealth of this country. So I think the stereotypes are intense because they're in defense of a whole system that really, as we've said, just favors the people who are in the dominant group.
Okay.
So okay. Every stereotype, if you hear one, question it.
Question it. Yeah, absolutely. No, totally. And do you have any advice for anyone who wants to start becoming more aware of their biases? Like, how did you do it?
You know, I did it a lot through reading. That happens to be, I don't know in your faith community, but in mine, there's this thing called devotional reading where you read supposedly from the Bible and to nourish your own spiritual life. So I changed my definition of devotional reading, and I really felt like my devotional reading was reading everything I could get my hands on. Wow. By African-American writers. So I've missed a lot of great books by white people, but it's just my decision. You know, it's my, so reading becomes it's not action in itself, but it can teach you so much that you then don't have to ask your friends of color to teach you, which is good. Cause so many white people say, oh, I'll just go ask so-and-so because they're black. They can tell me about this. Well, that person probably has better things to do than educating their white friend. So I would say really read a lot. There's amazing literature by African Americans, by Latinx people, there's, you know, the whole group of people, indigenous people. There's if you want to know what someone's life is like. Not, you know, is you can't generalize, but you just read their memoirs, read their fiction. And that starts to change something inside you. There's also much more active, there's activism that we also need to do, but that's the answer that comes up to me for
Yeah.
your question.
And there are also a lot of good movies now. I mean, 10 Years a Slave. I don't know if you, is it 10 Years a Slave? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is. I watched that movie and I was
brutally,
like,
yes.
Oof, that left an impression on me, that movie, because it really, it made it more real to me. You know, the, mm-hmm. all the pain that, you know, the blacks had to go through mm-hmm. In history. So mm-hmm. it made it more visceral yes. for some reason, because, you know, just seeing it mm-hmm.
Exposed, opening our eyes in whatever yeah. way we can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then there's some important work that's been done studying the period after World War II, when, the people talk about the wealth gap between white people and black people. Let's say, just to take that. Those two groups. And there's all these stereotypes and myths that we've been talking about, like, well, black people just don't, they don't value education, or they don't do this, or they don't do that. In fact, after World War II, when white soldiers, white GIs came home, there was what was called the GI Bill that allowed them to get really good deals on mortgages on new houses. And the black GIs who had gone through the same risks and fought the same war came home, and because of federal housing policies, they could not get mortgages for all these new houses that were being made available to the white GIs. And 40 years later, those white families have built up equity in those homes and have money to borrow on to send their kids to college. 20 years later, 30 years later. And the black families who didn't get to do that are still living, in let's say rental housing, where they're not building equity. Or like my friend Mary bought her own house, but the bank charged her more than they would have charged a white person.
Really?
Because of
because of
the neighborhood that her house was in.
Oh, wow.
So, okay. So that's the cause, that's the most essential cause of the wealth gap, is that racist application of housing guidelines and housing laws. So,
and not to mention education, access to good education.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So studying that kind of thing is really important as a white person to understand, because I think white people, you know, work hard and work hard for what they get. At the same time, it's like they're starting, if you're starting a race, the white people are starting a half a mile ahead of a similar black person because we have those privileges and mm-hmm. we've had, you know, middle-class families at least have gotten to build up equity and send their kids to college and that kind of thing. So it all's part of the same picture. And the more I feel, the more we can know that as white people, the more conscious we can be, we can maybe start to counteract that greed.
And perhaps they can find their own version of Mary. Maybe they can find one, a friend who is from, you know, from another race.
Well, maybe they can be worthy of that friendship. That's what I felt like I tried to do. I tried to make myself a more dependable friend.
Oh, but, okay.
That's another way. I'm just saying what you're saying, but in a different way.
Yeah.
To be prepared to be a more dependable friend.
A more dependable friend.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think so. And I just wanted to say that I think that also we haven't talked about class at all.
Let's talk about that.
Well, I think that because when I talk about the gap, the equity, the wealth gap, there's mm-hmm. also a huge gap between working class white people and more affluent white people. And that for some of the same reasons, which is a system that's set up to really favor the dominant economic group, but the white working class people get set against the black working class people, like racism allows them to the white people to blame black people mm-hmm. or to think it's their fault. And so the two groups are set against each other that are really at heart need to be allies. So it's just another
because they share that commonality. They share that commonality.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's where the stereotypes and the segregated lives and the fear really exacerbate something that could be, this could be a group that really worked together to make the whole country economically more just and more fair.
Okay.
That's my two cents.
Thank you. And very quickly, do you have any suggestions for people who want to be more actively involved in, you know, actually doing something and volunteer and activism, something like that?
Yes, that's, I'm sure you do too. And I hope you'll add to it. I think so. As a white person, brought up to feel like my voice is more important, I would go into a group, let's say a mixed group that's working on some activist, with some activist goal. And white people tend to go in and just start talking and take over and think they know what to do. And so I think listening is a really good first step in activism. You find there's so many social issues. Even in my book, there's, domestic worker rights, there's incarceration, there's, several, and you just see which one really draws you and that you'd like to try to make a difference in. Enter, find a group in your community that's working on it. Go in and listen. Do not just march in and think you know what to do. And take leadership from the people of color who've been working on this for a long, long time. And then gradually find what you can do and what you can contribute and start working together. So that's one answer anyway. How about you?
Oh, that's great advice. Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, my activism happens with my writing. I try to educate people.
Yes.
So as you said, educating and bringing more self-awareness. I love to write about these topics. So, which is why I wanted to have you on the show because I want to use my platform to have you know, people like you who share the same values and the same ethos when it comes to mm-hmm. these issues. So maybe later on, I'll do something more, do more. Now, there is more I want to do for sure.
Well, but writing is such a tool, such an important tool. I'm really glad to hear you talk about that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm doing my best.
Yeah. Well, and you've built, you know, people who really trust what you have to say and listen to your podcast and listen to your guests. And that's big. And I wanted to tell you, Mary is 81 now and I'm 77 and we talk on the phone a lot.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And we've both turned out to be very progressive minded politically. So we're just always ranting about some recent right-wing thing that happened. And, it was so great to discover that about each other.
Wow. So you've been friends your whole life, practically whole life.
That's practically. Incredible. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Wow. That is so inspiring. And I'm so glad that you took her advice and wrote a book about it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And thanks for reading that book. Thank you. And thanks for
talking with me. Absolutely. Wendy, it's been a true pleasure. And I just want to thank you for bringing awareness to this very, very important issue. We really need more people like you out there to make us more conscious and more loving. Definitely.
Yes. And not blaming ourselves, just looking forward and seeing what we can do differently.
Absolutely. I just want to mention very quickly for anyone who's interested in learning more about Wendy's book, These Walls Between Us, A Memoir of Friendship Across Race and Class, you can now find it in all major bookstores. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you just heard, please subscribe to my podcast and feel free to share it with your friends and family. Take care and speak soon.